Well, we're drawing closer to the end of the year and, in fact, the end of a decade. So as part of our last live program of the year, Summer Saturday Extra starts next week, we would like to consider some of the major international trends and events that have shaped the past decade, a lot culminating, I think, this past year, and to look forward to 2020, which probably will be rather a dramatic one in world affairs. Joining me are Dr. Michael Fullilove, Executive Director of the Lowy Institute for International Affairs, and Daniel Franklin, editor of The Economist's Future Gazing, The World in 2020 edition, which is always, well, that world is edition is always very awaited. Michael, Daniel, welcome to you both.
Good morning.
Thank you very much.
And Daniel, I'm going to come to the big, the tsunami election just a little bit later, which I'm very much looking forward to your analysis. But Michael Fullilove, the biggest international story here in Australia, I think you'll agree, has been China. Now, a significant strand of the Australian media and others see it as looms as a big growing threat, and that's been a very strong sense coming through. Others, like, say, James Curran, a professor of modern history at the University of Sydney, saw it quite differently, and he suggested in an article this week in the Australian Financial Review, the China threat rhetoric, he said, has now morphed not only into a classic red scare, but also a paranoid syndrome. We are very close to being told to start looking under beds again. And he suggested that the chance for sober management of our relationship with Beijing is also fast slipping away. How do you suggest we think about this next stage?
Well, I think you're right that China has in the last year become the biggest news story in the country, and every day there are front page stories, whether it's Hong Kong or Xinjiang or political donations or cyber hacks or foreign investment or detention of Australians or the trade war or Manchurian candidates or defectors. I mean, it's hard to keep up, and I think it points to the problem, the difficulty for a mid-sized liberal democracy maintaining and working out a relationship with a regional giant that's run by a Leninist political party. This is the problem that is not going away. I don't think we have found our settling point on China. And I do think that in the last few weeks, it's felt like the debate is spinning out of control a little bit. And I think in the new year, what we have to do is find our settling point, identify where our interests overlap. And when our interests overlap and we have lots of positive interests with China, we need to be ambitious in the way we cooperate with China. And where our interests diverge, we need to be very clear and consistent about that. But at the moment, I don't think we have quite found that settling point.
And can you see people, are some leading the way and some not? I suppose I'm not asking you really to single out people, but I'm trying to flesh out how we might develop a different language, which is what I think you're hinting at, so that the overlaps can be named and, I suppose, celebrated and given a bit of consolation in that without in any shape or form being seen to surrender to things we don't like.
Well, I think that the intensive news focus on China, I think, has been a good corrective. I think the Australian debate has been a bit slow to wake up to the reality of China, and I think the focus on foreign interference, some of the scoops have opened our eyes to what kind of state we're dealing with. So I think that's good. The problem is that China's not going anywhere, and we're not going anywhere. And, you know, nearly 40% of our exports at the moment go to China. And so what we have to do is think, how do we have a clear-eyed relationship with them, never bending on our values? And also, I think, Geraldine, not shrinking Asia to the dimensions of China, which is something we're in danger of doing now, but remembering there are lots of big Asian countries, including India and Indonesia and Vietnam and Japan and others. And in fact, it plays into China's hands for us to sort of identify the whole of Asia with China. We need to diversify our relationships with China. We need to be tough-minded, but we can't allow the debate to spin out of control because they're not going anywhere and we need to have a positive relationship with them.
Now, Daniel, you sit in a different part of the world. I wonder how you, as you view the lot of all of us, how will countries have to work out the need, how to position themselves between, say, between China and the US, do you think? Is that one of the trends that you've seen unfold in this last decade and likely to remain?
Yes, absolutely. And actually, as it happens right now, I'm sitting not in my own country, Britain, but in America. And America is grappling with very much the same sorts of things that Michael's just been talking about. And that it, too, has rather, I think, belatedly woken up to the idea that China is a major strategic challenge back to the age of an age of great power competition. And there's a sense, I think it's one of the rare things where there's a lot of bipartisan agreement these days in Washington that this is not just about a trade war, it's a much deeper phenomenon across the board, and it stretches across the strategic dimension and very much actually at the front line nowadays, technology too, and who controls the next generation of digital platforms. And that question involves all America's allies. So we are all under pressure, for example, not to buy technology on 5G telecoms, for example, that might endanger strategic cooperation with America.
Yes, and I was just thinking, for instance, of these dramatic developments in India where the new citizenship laws, the draft of them, will exclude Muslims. Now, that is, talk about a threat to our values, and yet at the same time, Daniel, I'll take it to you first, Australians are being strongly urged to look to India as well for a range of reasons. I mean, there's a clear and present little challenge.
Yes, and India is a sort of swing country that could side with the West, if we can still call it that, more than with China. But it's a disturbing one. It is a democracy, but under Mr. Modi, it's gone in a very populist and worrying direction in terms of his policies towards Hindu nationalism, essentially. And I think the West needs to remind him and be clear that this is not something that it's in favour of.
Look, I'm just going to move on to another huge story this year, the protests in Hong Kong. And this was a major divergence, Daniel, from your predictions for 2019 when you were looking ahead. Yeah. It just sort of exploded, didn't it? Where do you think it's heading as we move into 2020?
Yes, it's sort of flared up and has lasted, for 6 months or so now. And the problem with it is, I think, that there's no real end game in sight. And the Hong Kong administration responded vigorously and quickly in terms of drawing back the original provocation, which was the extradition law, then this might not have lasted so long, but they've been slow and now the demands have escalated and it's actually very hard to see how it ends. And I think that's a real problem for China too, and it will play, I think, most immediately next year into the elections in Taiwan, which happen in January. And they're watching very closely Hong Kong as a kind of warning sign to them.
Michael, your thoughts on Hong Kong?
Well, I think it's very sad because I have enormous affection for Hong Kong, as a lot of Australians do, and I really admire the protesters because they are standing up, they're fighting against an implacable force, and I fear that they have no chance of winning in the long term because the PRC is not going to allow a part of China to remain democratic, let alone independent, and in fact, the internal calculus of the Communist Party and Zhong Nanhai will mean that over the long term, Hong Kong will have to be punished for this. Perhaps not in the short term, because as Daniel says, they don't want to turn this small problem into a big problem. But over the long term, it's hard to see how these young people can win or how these Hong Kongers can win. And therefore, you know, the greatest courage is the courage that you show when your hopes of success are very, very slim.
Mm. Now, I'm going to, because I've really got quite a bit to get through, I want to go to the re-election of Boris Johnson as Prime Minister in the UK. Now, Daniel, did this come as a surprise to you? What does it mean for your predictions regarding Brexit?
Well, it's not a total surprise, because the opinion polls were pointing to a big Conservative lead, but it's very much at the outer end of what people thought would actually happen. And it's a stunning victory. I mean, it's an 80-seat majority. It means that Brexit is now no longer in doubt for the first time, really, since that vote 3.5 years ago. And we will have Brexit under Boris Johnson's deal at the end of January. But that really just sets up the next struggle over Brexit, which is what the future trading relationship is with the European Union. This is just the divorce agreement. We have to work out how we relate in future to the EU. And internally, I think it sets up an intriguing question of the unity of the United Kingdom, because the Scottish Nationalist Party, which wants another referendum, pretty much swept the board in Scotland. And there's also a question now over the future of Northern Ireland. So, and whether it might be more inclined to
link up with ERA.
Yeah, so I think, triumph for Boris Johnson, but he's got his hands full over the next year and beyond.
But I wonder whether, the more you think about it, there's a sort of a, well, who knows exactly what governed everybody, but is there a sort of a yearning for a different world for a lot of people in the UK, that the modern world, as it, in terms of its linkage with Europe being only part of it, whether there's something very deep there that we need to look at in terms of trying to understand the range of emotions that are going to swirl around us in this next decade to come, Daniel?
Well, I think there's a lot to that in what gave us the support for Brexit in the first place. But I don't think that the UK is alone in that. And Michael might bring other examples too. But it seems to me that some rather similar impulses produced Donald Trump's victory in the United States and some other election results around Europe and beyond. So. I think this is not just a British phenomenon. This is a concern that is partly a reaction to the global economic crisis still, I think, partly a reaction to just the sheer speed at which the world is changing because of technology and globalization. And people are, the famous phrase of the Brexit campaign was take back control. And I think that's what a lot of people fundamentally feel, a sense that they have been losing control and yearn for an era where at least they felt they had more of it.
Well, maybe it is the rise of China too. The tectonic plates seem to be shifting, to use a cliche, and so the whole thing seems very brittle. Whether it is, I'm not saying it is. It seems so.
Gerald, sorry.
Go on, Michael. Go on.
Well, just to weigh in on Boris, I agree with Daniel and your question, Geraldine, about the forces that drove Brexit. But in terms of the factors that drove this election result, I would say it's a much more old-fashioned result, where a more attractive candidate beat a less attractive candidate, where a more centrist candidate beat a more extreme left-wing candidate. And I always felt that Boris's opponents underestimated his strengths as a politician because he's a compelling figure, and they overestimated his weaknesses. And so I think that Brexit is a grave unforced error, but I think that Boris had the advantage over Theresa May of believing in Brexit and therefore being able to unite the Brexiteers and bring the ultras over to a deal that was really not that different from what Theresa was proposing, and then uniting them on that. So I would say the election result, I think, is a much more sort of old-fashioned result. And if I can take one positive news out of it, I think one thing that I've been dismayed by over the last couple of years is the extent to which the UK has been divided and chaotic and the sort of the toxins in the UK political system. And the rest of us need a UK that is confident, that is thinking about things other than Brexit. So I know there's a long way to go. I know Brexit is not going to get done in the next week, and charting the future relationship will take a lot of time. But hopefully, this is, if it's not the beginning of the end, it's the end of the beginning. And hopefully we can welcome the UK back, because the West actually, in the face of all these other challenges you're asking about, Geraldine, we need Britain as a strong, engaged, liberal force in the world.
Look, I just, because I'm looking at the time, we've got a text here from Rod, and I think it's pertinent, Daniel. The biggest international news story is not China, but the future deterioration of our planet, climate change, loss of biodiversity, species extinction, soil deterioration, etc. These trends could bring the end of civilization as we know it. Now, Daniel, how do you, because you talk about this, obviously, how do you see this playing out in this next decade?
Well, certainly in the next year, there's going to be a lot of talk about it. We have the big climate conference that happens in Glasgow towards the end of next year. And you have the Greta Thunberg phenomenon that is, I think, putting a lot of pressure on politicians, but also businesses. And you find big American companies, for example, with the Business Roundtable, saying it's no longer all about maximizing shareholder value. It's about responsible husbandry of the planet as well. I think the real test is how much of that is actually going to be just talk, and how much is backed up by real action and real substance in policy terms. And the next 10 years is going to be critical for that. Also for the sorts of scientific advances, technological advances, that might make up for what the politicians are not doing.
And look, I'm going to have to give you the final word, Michael, just about what we expect with the US in this extraordinary year that's to come.
Well, I think we can finally say that now we have an election that is the most important in living memory, because if Donald Trump is re-elected, then I think the deep state will start to wither away, and the changes that he sort of wants will start to be embedded. If, on the other hand, the Americans course correct, then I'm actually hopeful that a lot of the changes he's introduced are reversible. So fingers crossed.
Thank you very much indeed, gentlemen. That was a lot to cover. Dr. Michael Fullilove and Daniel Franklin from The Economist, Dr. Fullilove from the Lowy Institute. And I know that was just a sort of quick snatch through, but I think it was a good overview.